This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington, and here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Since 2000, the UN's World Health Organization reports 1.5 billion malaria cases and 7.6 million deaths have been averted globally. Some of the greatest achievements were made in sub-Saharan Africa, which bears the brunt of this deadly disease spread by mosquitoes.
That was Lisa Schlein in Geneva reporting on challenges in the fight against malaria. Details coming up. Also, Ethiopia's prime minister says Tigray region's leaders have fled the capital, Mekelle, and reports indicate xenophobic attacks on truck drivers have resurfaced in South Africa. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, we start with our top story. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed said today that the Tigray region's leaders had fled the capital, Mekelle, after almost 4 weeks of fighting, but that federal forces had refrained from attacking them because their wives and children were with them. The fugitive leader of the Tigray People's Liberation Front called on Abiy to withdraw troops from the region and asserted that fighting continues on every front, 2 days after Abiy declared victory. Debretsion Gebremichael, in a phone interview with the Associated Press, said he remains near the Tigray capital, Mekelle, which the Ethiopian army on Saturday said it's now controlled. He told the AP his forces are confident of victory. Abiy, on November 4th, ordered military operations against the TPLF leaders in response to what he said were attacks on federal army camps. The fighting has left thousands dead and prompted tens of thousands of refugees to flee into Sudan. Many refugees have reported that federal troops tried to keep them from crossing the border, and others have told journalists they were targeted by troops because they are Tigrayan. The fighting has been a dramatic escalation of tensions between Abiy and the leaders of the TPLF, which dominated Ethiopian politics for nearly 3 decades before anti-government protests swept Abiy to office in 2018. Abiy has said the federal military operation is aimed just at some TPLF leaders, while the TPLF says it is a war against the people of Tigray. The World Health Organization is calling on countries to step up the fight against malaria as the COVID-19 pandemic threatens to reverse important gains made in efforts to control this deadly disease over the past 20 years. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
This year's World Malaria Report celebrates the extraordinary progress in malaria control in the 20 years since African leaders at a summit in Abuja adopted a declaration pledging to work to stop the spread of the disease. Since 2000, the UN's World Health Organization reports 1.5 billion malaria cases and 7.6 million deaths have been averted globally. Some of the greatest achievements were made in sub-Saharan Africa, which bears the brunt of this deadly disease spread by mosquitoes. Additionally, the director of the WHO's Global Malaria Program, Pedro Alonso, says 21 countries have eliminated malaria over the last 2 decades. Of these, he says, 10 have been officially certified as malaria-free by the WHO.
That means that more than half of all the world's endemic countries are within reach of elimination. At the beginning of this century, 3 countries had less than 10 cases per year. Now we have 24 countries which are literally one step away from elimination.
Despite remarkable progress, however, the World Health Organization reports global gains have leveled off in recent years. This is because of insufficient funding and a lack of access to proven malaria control tools, such as insecticide-treated mosquito nets and preventive medicines for children. The emergence of the coronavirus pandemic is now posing an additional challenge to the malaria response. WHO's Regional Director for Africa, Matshidiso Moeti, says the gains made in Africa over many years against poverty and disease risk being reversed by the virus responsible for the COVID-19 disease.
Already, malaria causes a 1.3% loss in Africa's economic growth every year. And we know that the COVID-19 pandemic is projected to push sub-Saharan Africa into recession for the first time in 25 years. This incredibly challenging situation requires renewed commitment to sustain and accelerate the gains that have been made in the fight against malaria.
Moeti notes malaria continues to kill many more people than diseases like COVID-19 and Ebola. In 2019, the WHO reported the global tally of malaria cases was 229 million, including more than 400,000 deaths. It said 90% of these cases and deaths were in the African region. Most of the victims were children. The UN Health Agency reports global funding for malaria last year totaled $3 billion. This falls far short of the $5.6 billion needed to roll back malaria. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A face-to-face direct Libyan political dialogue forum resumed Monday in Morocco to work on a mechanism for selecting new executive authority comprising a reformed presidency council, a national unity government, and a separate prime minister. So far, a ceasefire has held in Libya since late October. Wolfgang Pashtai, former military attaché in Libya, spoke to VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shenawi about power sharing and prospects for a successful Libyan political agreement.
This is certainly a very positive movement, much better than the virtual meetings which resumed after the first round of meetings in Tunis. But nevertheless, it is quite unlikely that there will be a breakthrough. They are discussing mechanisms and criteria almost since the very beginning of the LPDF. I would say it is more likely that the LPDF will continue until the end of this year without any significant results, until the new UN special representative, probably the Bulgarian Nikolai Mladenov, comes in and takes over. I guess he will do a stocktaking of what has been achieved and most likely launch a new, or at least a modified initiative of what has been achieved until this moment. But in addition to the meeting today in Morocco, it was already a very positive move that last week more than 120 House of Representative members out of about 190 in total have met in Tanger, Morocco, for the first time since years. And they have agreed to come together to a next common meeting in Ghadames, a Libyan desert town close to the Algerian and Tunisian border, probably already this week or next week.
So what could make or break an agreement on power sharing in Libya?
Such an agreement must be first and foremost a Libyan agreement and not one dictated from the outside, not by UNSMIL, not by anyone else. But it must enjoy the acceptance of the international stakeholders who have most influence on the main warring factions in Libya, namely Turkey and Qatar on one side and Egypt, the Emirates and Russia on the other side. A key element is that the real legitimacy must come from within Libya, not from someone appointed by UNSMIL or by the UN Security Council. It must come from within Libya. And I see three options for this. It could be either the House of Representatives and the High Council of State together, or this could come from an assembly of the elected municipal representatives in some form of grassroots democracy, or this could come by a referendum on such an agreement by the broader population. Such an agreement needs to include a formula for the distribution of the oil revenue. It needs to have a regional approach. A centralized stabilization is not realistic. And important element is also that there must not be any losers. Anyone of the broader population must feel that he is somehow a winner, that he has a benefit from the agreement.
What are the real prospects for a successful Libyan political agreement that avoids the mistakes of the previous one on Al-Sukhayrat?
Unfortunately, the current Libya Political Dialogue Forum does not avoid these previous mistakes, and therefore it will lead to nowhere. It has a lack of legitimacy of the delegates which were selected by UNSMIL. There are well-founded allegations of corruption and vote buying. And the UNSMIL roadmap foresees that the outcome, the selection of names for this top positions, should be confirmed by the House of Representatives and the High Council of States to provide legitimacy. Well, this sounds good, but it is also foreseen in this roadmap, if these two do not agree within 60 days, these decisions shall be referred back to the Libya Political Dialogue Forum to take action. And this is certainly not a way of legitimating any outcomes. So all these mistakes need to be avoided by a new approach. And I guess we will see a new approach early next year with the new incoming special representative.
A stable ceasefire is crucial for any political agreement in Libya. Could the military track succeed in maintaining such a stable ceasefire without international monitoring?
This is highly unlikely. Right now, there is again a build-up of forces from both sides. The LNA has brought forward reinforcements to the area of Sirte and also to the Jufra oasis. The Islamist Defend Benghazi brigades have assembled. Turkish artillery has been deployed to Al-Bashqa, about 100 kilometers to the west of Sirte. While a major outbreak of hostilities is still very unlikely, the stage is set for some serious ceasefire violations. One must be also aware that even a stable ceasefire in the Sirte area between the main warring factions will not solve all the country's security problems. Disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration of militias remains a big issue. It did not even start, and it's the biggest problem in the greater Tripoli area. Terrorism must not be forgotten. It's still a huge threat. Just last Saturday, the Libyan National Army conducted a raid in the Ubari area in southwestern Libya, arresting 7 members of the Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. Among them was a leading member of the organization just returning from an arms smuggling trip from Mali. This could trigger some more terrorist attacks as a revenge in the Fezzan area.
That was Wolfgang Parshtai, former military attaché in Libya, speaking to VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi. Deadly xenophobic attacks on truck drivers in South Africa have resurfaced, creating concerns for the South African road freight industry. Adigando gives us more on the story.
A week ago, a 45-year-old truck driver in South Africa was shot and killed, one of a string of attacks in the past few weeks. More than 35 trucks have been destroyed, a loss of around 120 million rand, according to the Federation of East and Southern Africa Road Transport Associations. The organization represents national road transportation associations in 14 Southern Africa countries. The Federation says since 2018, 1,200 vehicles and their cargoes have been destroyed in South Africa, mostly in attacks aimed at foreign drivers. Human Rights Watch and their rights groups estimate more than 200 people, mostly foreign truck drivers, who have lost their lives in the attacks. The recent attacks follow protests by the All Truck Drivers Foundation, an association of local South African truck drivers. Its members last week marched in Durban demanding the deportation of foreign nationals. The group says that 80% of truck drivers in the country are foreign nationals. Mary Paddy is the president of the Truckers Association of South Africa, another association of South African truck owners.
It's about 80% because we cannot come and deny that. As employers, there are things that you're not doing right. We can be able to fix them. So definitely we are on that process where it needs to be fixed. We did have a number of foreign drivers in our companies. What we know is that 80% of the foreign drivers are employed in South Africa as truck drivers.
The Federation of East and Southern Africa Road Transport Associations, FESATA, says there are about 6,000 cross-border drivers, and many of those are foreigners. Fitz Morris, the Federation's chief executive, says South Africa has 360,000 truck jobs in total.
I don't think they have the facts right, because if you take the population of trucks in South Africa, based on Enautis, it's about 360,000 trucks. Of that, approximately 6,000 trucks are operating on cross-border from South Africa into Zimbabwe, Zambia, DRC. If you take that 6,000 jobs as a total percentage of the 360,000 trucks in the country, it's 1.6%. And if 80% of that is foreign drivers, it works out to 1.3% of the total driving jobs in the country. It's a simple equation.
Stanley Muluka is the president of the Southern Africa Truck Drivers Association, which represents truck drivers within the SADC region.
If the South Africans manage, you know, the way they want it to be done, that they get all the jobs to themselves. And of course, if it so happened that all foreigners leave South Africa, I don't think it will be an easy thing for them to traverse other countries. We do have a report of 4 of our Zambian registered vehicles that were torched in South Africa. And you think the owners of that truck are happy about it? No, they are not. And therefore, they can take the jobs and let them traverse within their country. That is our position.
Fitzmaurice, with the regional freight companies group, says truck owners employ foreign truck drivers because they are familiar with their home countries, making it easier for South African goods to flow into the region. South African police have confirmed that more than 20 people have been arrested in connection with the attacks on truck drivers in recent weeks. That brings to 52 the number of suspects arrested since April in connection with attacks on a total of 70 trucks. Reporting for VOA, this is Adegondo in Bulawayo.
A delegation of Nigerian federal officials went to Borno State today to offer condolences over the deaths of at least 43 rice farmers killed by militants on Saturday. Nigerian news media reported that Senate President Ahmed Lawan led the delegation. The government says it is searching for the suspected Islamist militants blamed for the attack at the village of Koshobe near the state capital, Maiduguri. There are reports the militants tied up the farmers and slit their throats. The government has confirmed 43 farmers died, and there are reports some women may have been kidnapped. Borno State has been the center of an Islamic insurgency by the Boko Haram group for more than a decade. However, it is not yet clear who was responsible for the attack on the farmers. The South African Development Community, SADC, has agreed to a comprehensive regional response to fight Islamist insurgents in Mozambique. The regional bloc organ on security and defense met in Habrone last week to discuss the deadly conflict. From Habrone, Botswana, reporter Mokondisi Dube has the details.
SADC convened an extraordinary meeting for its organ on defense and security to discuss internal conflicts in the Democratic Republic of Congo and Mozambique. Botswana President Mokgweetsi Masisi, who is the chairperson of the SADC organ on defense and security, said regional leaders were concerned with terrorist attacks, particularly in Mozambique.
Of particular importance was the realization that incidents of terrorism are increasing in our region. To this end, the summit came up with a number of recommendations on how member states could deal with this imminent threat, including our commitment to the SADC Mutual Defense Pact.
Masisi added the regional body will improve security measures to fight insurgency.
Other practical and incremental steps that we agreed on include expediting the establishment of the SADC Regional Counterterrorism Center, as well as enhancing dedicated national counterterrorism coordination structures.
SADC Executive Secretary Stegomena Lawrence Tex said the meeting participants had agreed to complete a comprehensive strategy to help Mozambique.
The extraordinary organ Troika Summit noted with concerns the act of terrorism in the region, particularly in Cabo Delgado province of the Republic of Mozambique, and expressed continued SADC solidarity with Mozambique. The extraordinary organ Troika Summit directed the finalization of a comprehensive regional response and support to the Republic of Mozambique to be urgently considered by summit.
Attacks by Islamist militants in the Cabo Delgado province have left at least 2,000 civilians dead over the past few years, while thousands have been displaced. Head of states from Botswana, DRC, Malawi, South Africa and Zimbabwe attended the extraordinary meeting, while Tanzania and Mozambique sent senior government officials. For VOA, this is Mqondisi Dube in Habaroni, Botswana.
A new report by the Overseas Development Institute, or ODI, in the United Kingdom concludes that China's increased engagement with Africa in recent years has resulted in positive change in some economies on the continent. But the change has sometimes happened at a cost to the African nations and has come about in sometimes unexpected ways. Darren Taylor has more.
ODI development economist Linda Calabrese studied whether Chinese investment in Africa has led to a transition from the continent's traditional low productivity sectors to more modern, productive economies.
One narrative that was very much present a few years back in the discussion is that production is becoming increasingly expensive in China. So labor costs are rising, production costs are rising. So therefore, Chinese companies are becoming less competitive and they seek to relocate their production in other countries. And this was seen as an opportunity for Africa to grab.
The talk, she says, was of Africa becoming China's factory. It would produce the goods that China's booming economy needed, and in so doing, would itself develop and make a lot of money. However, the evidence collected by Calabrese shows things haven't turned out this way.
Actually, Chinese investment in Africa are mostly interested in the African market, for the African market itself. So not to use African countries as a low-cost production for exports, but rather to service the African markets, to fill the gaps that are there in terms of, you know, specific products or services that are needed.
The Economist says Africans are indeed benefiting from Chinese products, but it's the Chinese making money, not Africans. African economies truly benefit, says Calabrese, when Chinese firms invest in more productive sectors such as manufacturing and construction. This creates what she calls a positive loop.
Construction, for example, the construction industry or construction investment in certain countries have led to an increased demand for construction material. And this has in turn led to the creation of construction material industries in these countries that weren't existing before. And this has therefore facilitated investment not only by other Chinese investors, but also by other foreign and domestic investors.
Her research shows that engagement with China has in some cases established economic sectors that previously didn't exist.
So, for example, demand for specific types of resources such as timber in Zambia has created a whole new export sector for this timber specifically.
Calabrese says China's building of infrastructure in various parts of Africa has allowed economic activities to flow more easily than in the past, which in turn has encouraged more investment from other foreign and domestic companies.
However, this impact is not uniform and it's not the same across all countries. Of course, even globally, we see these trends. So there's research that shows that Chinese investment has had a stronger growth effect in African and Asian economies and much less in Latin America, for example. But even within Africa, we see a lot of differences and a lot of different outcomes.
The ODI report concludes that concerns about cheap Chinese goods harming African producers are valid.
But we have also seen that imports of Chinese goods, specifically machinery and equipment, has enabled the creation of new industries in African countries. So therefore, the structural transformation impact also comes through trade, not just through investment.
Calabrese says Chinese companies have created a lot of jobs for Africans. But this, she adds, has been accompanied by plenty of friction between African workforces and unions and Chinese managers. The Economist says the Chinese demand tighter controls over workers, who in turn see this as unfair. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
Brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to sukus, afrobeat to ndombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
The Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 1705 UTC on The Voice of America.